And as I walked along, it was so dark that I could see absolutely nothing. The only way I knew I was on the road was by the sound of my feet hitting the hard pavement as opposed to the soft dirt to the sides. And I knew that there were trees on both sides sort of looming up, almost covering the road. And as I walked, I had 12 miles to walk. In the drizzle and in the dark, I began to see things. My only great gratitude is that at this point I had not seen a movie I saw later called American Werewolf in Paris. I'm not getting excited. Beware of the moors! But I really actually felt every druid spirit of Wales dancing out of those trees around me, and it became quite vivid and really, in a sense, terrifying. I was just trying to keep my little heart from beating right out of its chest. Until finally, after about 5 miles, I saw a glimmer of light in the distance of an inn. I was never so happy to see light in darkness. But you see, the alchemical process at this time was not so very different. The alchemists had a story that had come to them. It was a tradition, it was an old tradition, about a work to be done, about a light in matter, about the possibility of performing a transformation, of savings from dark matter, something golden and precious. And so they began to work. And they compounded, and they extracted, and they heated and combined. They sniffed incredible chemical fumes. And as they looked in their alembics, they saw things. They didn't know what they were seeing. They projected, however, shall we say, psychic material into it. And in the alembic, they saw kings and queens, green dragons and red dragons at war. Elements divided, elements seeking union. If you look at these old alchemical texts, they are really quite hallucinatory. The stories they made up about what they were seeing had nothing, of course, to do with what we might call chemical reactions. They had a whole lot to do, however, about the psychic landscape of the image within being projected upon the alembic. The work had its phases. The alchemists spoke generally about three common phases of this work. There was the negredo, the albedo, and the rubido. The negredo was the beginning place, the darkening. It was a destruction. They called it the destruido. It was a tearing, a rending. Before the work could begin, everything had to be broken down into a primary substance. All form had to be made formless. We might compare this on our own psychological processes. When we begin a journey, say, of transformation, of change, well, the first thing we have to do is break out of what was. And in the beginning of their activity, their process, their work, there was a need to break the, shall we say, consensus reality of substance itself. This involved a grinding, a dissolving, a tearing, a rending. And it was seen actually psychologically as an extremely painful process in which the alchemist himself was being rent, was being torn, was being dissolved. His assumptions about the work were being leveled. Then after this dark negredo, there came what was known as an albedo, a washing. The word itself means a whitening. From the darkness, from the night of projection, the alchemist began to see actions within the alembic, within the crucible, under his slow, steady flame. the opposites themselves began to appear. The opposites in contention, which he was seeking to unify. Because the sense of the alchemical work was that there were two great powers in opposition, a king, a queen, a salt, a sulfur. And the alchemist was seeking, through the mediation of a spirit known as Mercurius, Mercury, to unify the salt, the watery, feminine, and the sulfur, the fiery, caustic, masculine, into a stone, into one thing, into the philosopher's stone. And in the albedo, in the washing, in the whitening, the images began to appear. And if he kept to the work, if he paid it enough attention, if he paid enough attention to those forces, slowly, through much trial, and with many failures, he could reach the stage of the rubedo, the reddening, the black stage, the white stage, the red stage. Red was, of course, in this time, the color of wedding. This was the marital color. And in the rubedo, it was seen as if blood, as if life itself was coming back into the alembic. And this life was a unifying life. At this point, the opposites began to conjoin. The salt and the sulfur formed miraculously into a single one. And from that one was born what was known as the Filius Philosophorum, the son of the philosophers, the stone, the elixir, the magical transformation. Did anyone make this stone? Oh, there are legends of those who made gold. There are legends of those who found the stone. But by the 16th century, alchemy had developed a very intense spiritual or philosophical element. And it was quite clear to the alchemists of that late age that their work, their magical work, was taking place as much within themselves as it was within the crucible. They said that orum nostrum non est orum vulgi. Our gold is not the vulgar gold. What we're seeking is not the type of gold you think. They said, they understood, that indeed the crucible was the soul of the alchemist itself, seeking a unification, a transformation. Well, what are these dual forces, this king and queen? The alchemists were looking for what they called a royal wedding. This is an image you see repeatedly in the old alchemical texts. It's a wedding of sol, sun, and luna, of moon, of king and queen, of feminine and masculine forces, a union that is androgynous and transformative. They had terms for the opposites, innumerable terms for these opposites that they saw in the albedo. They divided, discriminated the opposites and sought their union. Oh, light, dark, salt, sulfur, hard, liquid. Light of sun, light of moon. It's rather as if they were trying, and I should say that, again, that the image of the wedding was known as the Mysterium Conjunctionis, the mystery of the conjunction. It was a hieros gamos, a holy wedding. That was the ultimate act of the work. Well, one might divide these forces into terms, feminine and masculine. Going back to the Gnostic mythologies, from which alchemy probably took some first relationship, there was this Sophia and a Logos. Sophia was feminine. She was the wisdom indwelling in matter itself. Logos was the rational power, the word, the verb that was seeking her. Reason goes with that bright word, that bright logos. and with wisdom, imagination. They were taking two things that they did not quite understand and trying to bring them into unity. One we might, in our own mind, see as consciousness. The light, reasonable, daylight awareness of our world. That they were trying to wed. That they were trying to bring into unity with a dark, material, imaginative world, an unconscious world, a dream world. Awake and dream. They were trying to wed an exterior fact with an interior story. And from that wedding, that crossing, bring forth a new substance. Just as they saw Christ in the Opus Divinum, in the divine work, in the world of light, so they saw the spirit of Mercurius, the dark one, working for them in the alchemical work, in the Opus Alchemicum. From this mixing of imagery, Jung saw in the alchemists individuals who were walking a path similar to his own, an imaginative path, seeking a mystery in matter, bringing forth contents of the unconscious, leaving record of them in their treatises, in their illustrations. And from this fiery magma, he found a stone that he could work. From approximately 1930 until the end of his life, Jung turned his concentrations to the legacy of alchemy, trying to decipher from this Western tradition the evidences of an unconscious realm and of the archetypes of that realm. I told you that the center of the alchemical work was in the Studium Conjunctionis. And it is to that subject that Jung turned his concentrations in his last years. We live, you see, once again, in a single visioned world. To us, all reality is matter, material reality. Our science studies matter. And it's mysteries. Oh, it has mysteries, for sure. Our psychology looks to the unconscious as a repository, perhaps of instinctual forces coming forth from the matter, from the DNA. If there's anything in our unconscious, it is behaviorally created. It's created by our experiences. It's one single dimension. Jung understood, in the depth of his own experience of the psyche, of the soul, that there was a second reality playing in the equation. And if you don't understand this, if you can't understand this, you'll never understand Jung. When he talks of the collective unconscious, people think he's talking of some sort of instinct, something, you know, somewhere up here in the frontal lobes hidden away as a result of our evolutionary process. But that's not the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious, this deeper objective psyche within us, is not a product of flesh, you see. He is really suggesting throughout his work, in subtle way, couched in scientific terminology for sure, that there is a secondary reality, a reality rooted before time and before space, a reality of spirit that is interdependent. Sekhti time. It's a light, an uncreated light, perhaps, a light perhaps captured in creation in the first moments of the Big Bang. Where it comes from is a mystery, but it is here, it is present. And it touches us. It influences us. Of course, yes, of course, in the deeper levels of our psychological makeup, there's plenty of stuff that comes purely from our personal experiences, our traumas, our sorrows, our pains, be they the pain of birth or the pain that follows daily after birth. There's a lot of it. And there's a lot of that pain, that repression, that attempted forgetting in our unconscious. And for sure, it plays havoc with our daily world. It makes us nasty when we should be kind. It makes us fail to be loving when love is indeed the cure. It harasses us. Each and every one of us. And we need to face that darkness, that shadow which is ours. But passing through that personal shadow, that personal legacy, there are deeper sources. There's a light, an eternal light, somehow captured in this matter of ourselves. It comes forward from our unconscious, the deepest levels of our unconscious. Now, I spoke of Jung's delving after this in the activity of imagination, intentional, imaginative, meditative efforts. But of course, there's another place that comes to us all the time, in our dreams. I mean, some hours, hopefully, several, every day, we do descend into that unconscious realm. And oh yes, I know that sometimes the dreams we encounter there are simply reflections of the anxieties and problems of our daily lives. I have spent many nights dreaming about my days of work. In fact, last night was one of them. But there are moments in that dream world when dreams come to us from a much deeper level than the personal level. Big dreams. Really big things. Oh, yes, 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 of course, there's a lot of the noise. But sometimes something breaks through with a message. It comes from something quite different than ourselves. I remember a dream I had once that just absolutely impressed this upon me. It was probably more than 20 years ago. I dreamt that I had killed a brother, my brother. I don't have a brother. It was an ancient dream. It was somehow intense. The action of the killing was not there, but there, the realization that I'd killed something that was my brother. And I remember awakening from the dream, hoping as I awakened, thinking as I awakened, that it was not true, that it was just a dream. But then, when I found myself fully awake, I realized that it was absolutely true that I had killed this brother. But then I realized that I was still dreaming. I was dreaming, I was awake in my bed, exactly where I was, facing the dream and its reality, realizing that the dream had been true, but I was still dreaming. And I didn't want to have the blood of this murder on my hands. And so I struggled and I awakened again. And finally I thought, well, I'm awake here and, oh God, what a dream. And then it came startlingly apparent to me that it was not a dream, that it was still true. And I realized for a second time that there I was in my bed And I was still dreaming. And finally, I struggled and awakened for the third time. And I mean, it's like, you know, pinch yourself, pull your hair. I was really awake. I was there in exactly the same spot that I had been in the prior two awakenings. And this time I was awake. And I realized it really was a dream. Except I realized it was still true. And I went down that day. I read the story of Cain and Abel. And I spent a very long day in consideration of what brother it was that I might have. What brother? In that dream, I guess what I realized is that the brother I had killed in an act of rationality in my adolescent years, to perhaps be personal. I had moved away from that spirit brother, you know, that intuitive brother, that brother who was willing to dream. I'd forgotten him, and it was time to turn back to him. I'd cast him into the earth as had been cast, dear old Cain. Well, you see, in each of us, each one of us here has had dreams like that, dreams that come from deeper levels with deeper messages. Where do they come from? What story are they trying to tell us? Perhaps they're trying to tell us that we, each of us, have a mate, a brother, a sister. Something that is actually as much us as this ego self we call ours. But we don't own it. It has an independent existence. It walks with us, unbeknownst. And unbeknownst, unrecognized, unseen, unheralded, it can cause us quite a few problems. It can trip us up. It cries out to us, awaiting our recognition of it. A duality in us, seeking a wedding, a union. The old Gnostic myths told of five sacraments. They spoke of a baptism and a chrism, an anointing, and a Eucharist, the Holy Supper. And then of two mysteries, two sacraments now unknown to history. One was called the redemption. It was a salvation. And the last, the highest sacrament of Gnosticism, was known as the bridal chamber. It was a union of something, male and female. It's been suggested that perhaps it was a union of man and woman, maybe. But if it had been a union of man and woman, it was clearly a union of spiritual and spiritual as well. A union. That sacred wedding, that hieros gamos, was sought in the myth of alchemy as well. A union of opposites, masculine, feminine, light, dark, sun, moon, king, queen. The union was sought in the alembic, the crucible, of the worker of the ancient work, of the alchemist himself. And it was seen in the alchemical science that if this magic work could be accomplished, if this union took place, there was a transformation. A magical transformation, and that thing transformed all it touched. The person who is truly whole, not half, not one half, a murderer of another half, a forgetter of another half. The human being who is truly whole, who has come to that cross of light and life and found herself in the Omega, that person radiates a transformative healing force in this world. A stone that touches and changes. It need not stand up upon an altar. It need not appear on talk radio. It need not give seminars. By its very presence in this world, it touches and changes. That was the alchemical work that Jung was studying. In the first talk here, I mentioned the myth of one Merlin. You'll remember that Merlin of old was born in a strange way. He was fathered by a demon from the darkness of earth and a holy virgin, a mirror image of the Christ story, whose father was a god above and a human woman. This Merlin, a mix of two natures, dark, light, dark masculine, light feminine, and Christ, light father, dark mother, we might say, human, divine, were mirror images of each other. Merlin came into the world, lost between those two realities, and he became a prophet. He became the prophet of a task, of a quest, of a journey, of a sacred object, of a grail. A series of imaginative legends that became a new canon, a new sacred text to the second millennia of the Christian era. He came at the exact time that alchemy burst into the Western imagination, when the Western imagination turned from its solitary fixation upon the light of the divine and turned again to the mystery of matter. Alchemy sought that mystery. You remember the story of Merlin, how he met a young woman, Niniana, and fell in love. How she was a scholar, a wise woman, learned in the seven arts, a clerk she was. And what did she want from Merlin? Teach me your secrets. Teach me your secrets. And, well, Merlin taught her well. And what was the last art that Merlin taught? He taught her how to build a tower strong, without window, without door, in which he himself might be locked forevermore. It's a story, you see. Does it have a meaning? I see in that wizard story the story of our own culture, the story of alchemy, the story of your soul and my soul, of our Western cultural psyche. We turn from our bright preoccupation in the 11th and 12th century to the mystery of matter and alchemy. Alchemy sought a spark, a light locked in matter, taught perhaps by a wizard. It turned its magic art. And that rational, that learned young woman, who is perhaps the psyche of the West, learned in the seven arts, a clerk, not a witch, not a magician. She learned the arts of that Merlin. She learned to dissect matter. She learned to make transformations, to make one thing into another, make hydrogen into helium. Make forces of the suns and the gods, forces of creation erupt and destroy. She learned well her art. She turned to that matter. She learned well. She learned how to make plastics and steels. She learned how to make space rocks. She learned how to make tools of mass destruction. She learned how to make our world imaginative, wondrous. She learned how to make images dance upon walls, telling us ancient myths. She learned how to to make music play in our ears as we jogged around the block. But Merlin, in the process of her learning, the old wizard, he got locked in the tower. He got locked up and forgotten. The alchemical myth turned to matter and its mysteries, and from it came chemistry, ultimately. But in that evolution, there was forgotten something. That the matter, being understood, contained a mystery, and that mystery has been and remains forgotten. As Jung looked at the alchemical sciences, as he looked at that history, it was that forgotten thing that he sought again to bring to the recollection of our age, the mystery of the soul, the mystery of the light in the darkness. The wedding was yet to be celebrated. And the psyche of our time was the thread by which our world was sustained. If we would turn, if we would understand, that alone would be the salvation of our time. Or that genie, that learned woman who is our world soul today, would walk us to our own destruction. At the very end of his life, Jung carved a stone. From about the 1920s onward, he needed a place to meditate, a place to be by himself, a place to deal with his own images. And he built a tower in a little village called Bollingen, not too far from his home in Kunsnach, on the shores of Lake Zurich. I had the opportunity to visit the tower around 1988. And I'll confess to you another very personal secret. As we wandered through the gates, trespassing as we were to the old tower. As I approached the tower, I saw off in the trees Jung's outhouse. And before anything else, my first interest was to visit his outhouse. I find deep psychological significance in that. It may have had something to do with natural needs. It may have been entirely a spiritual thing. But you see, the old alchemists had a saying. They said, "Ins der Core in venitur." It lives in, how shall I translate the word, dung. It lives in dung. Mm-hmm. The magic spark, the prima materia from which the alchemical work was performed, it started with the most worthless substance, the thing discarded, the thing most common, the thing found in the street and perhaps stepped in the street. That's where it started. It started with the thing we most appreciate. It started with our own flesh. Instead of cordi and venitur. And I will leave you aware of one thing if you aren't aware, that each and every one of you is full of about 25 feet of that substance. Some more, some less, depending on the day. The old alchemist had another saying, which is, no fore sire in interiore homine habitat veritas. Don't go looking outside. In the interior of the human being dwells truth. It's in there too. Towards the end of his life, Jung felt inclined to carve upon stones. Of course, he had been working stone all of his life. That's the allusion he gives in the prologue of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. He talks about the fiery magma that crystallized into the stone that he had to work. This word stone was quite important to the old alchemists. It was the stone they sought, the philosopher's stone. As he was finishing his last work upon the tower in his late years, a stone arrived, a square stone, perfectly square stone, that had not been ordered for the construction, for the stonework. And the chief stonemason who was working with Jung on his tower, Jung did a lot of the stonework himself, was going to send it back. Jung saw the stone and said, no, that's mine. And he set it aside and he began to carve it. As he looked at the stone, he saw things in it. He saw lines that wanted to be expressed, and so he carved upon them. And then he saw texts upon it that seemed there in the stone that wanted to be let out, and he carved those upon it. He says, the first thing that occurred to me was a Latin verse by the alchemist Arnaldus de Villanova, who died in 1313. I chiseled this into the stone. In translation it goes, here stands the mean uncomely stone. 'Tis very cheap in price. The more it is despised by fools, the more loved by the wise. Next he had an image of a doll, of an eye. And he carved this. Time is a child, playing like a child, playing a board game, the kingdom of the child. This is Telephoros, who roams through the dark regions of the cosmos and glows like a star out of the depths. He points the way to the gates of the sun and to the land of dreams. And with that word, he carved an eyeball. And in the eyeball, there's a little figure carrying a lamp. See, because that's what pupila means. It means little puppet, your pupil. So when you look in the mirror, or if you look in somebody else's eye, you know, if you sort of look in the mirror of their eye, what do you see? You see a strange little figure looking into an eye. The pupila, the little puppet in the mirror of the eye. Well, he stands there, doesn't he? He stands there with a lantern. He stands at the gate of the sun in the land of dreams. He stands right betwixt the outer and the inner reality. He points the way to the gates of the sun and to the land of dreams. And the last inscription he wrote on the third side of the stone is an old Latin alchemical text. I am an orphan alone, nevertheless I am found everywhere. I am one, but opposed to myself. I am youth and old man at one and the same time. I have known neither father nor mother, because I had to be fetched out of the deep like a fish, or fell like a white stone from heaven. In the woods and mountains I roam, but I am hidden in the innermost soul of man. I am mortal for everyone, yet I am not touched by the cycle of aeons. And in conclusion, he wrote, in remembrance of his 75th birthday, C.G. Jung made and placed this here as a thanks offering in the year 1950. Thus the stone was finished. I looked at it again and again, wondering about it and asking myself, what lay behind my impulse to carve it? The stone stands outside the tower and is like an explanation of it. It is a manifestation of the occupant, but one which remains incomprehensible to others. Do you know what I wanted to chisel into the back face of the stone, that fourth side which had been left blank? The cry of Merlin. For what the stone expressed reminded me of Merlin's life in the forest, after he had vanished from the world. Men still hear his cries, so the legend runs, but they cannot understand or interpret them. The cry of Merlin. The Merlin locked in the tower. The Merlin wizard. You see, Jung had a bit of that wizard in him. He was seeking. He was seeking, indeed, to help us by his vision, to be a guide to a wisdom that was very ancient, a wisdom of the psyche, of the soul. That was his work to which he turned. So I'll stop there tonight and thank you very much. And now we have a few minutes if anyone wants to ask any questions or discussion. And if you have to run, I understand that too. Yes. Yeah, as I mentioned last week, that same question came up. Not only was he familiar with them, but he was instrumental in their publication. When the Gnostic Gospels were discovered in 1945, they essentially went onto the black market. They were found by a disreputable fellow, shall we say. They went onto the black market in Cairo. One of the codices or bound books, the first of the books, was smuggled out of Egypt. It went into Europe and was obtained by a fellow by the name of Hillel Quispe, a young scholar of Coptic, who immediately understood what this was. And he went to Jung to get the money to buy this thing on the black market. I think they paid 10,000 Swiss francs for it. And the Bullingen Institute, the Jung's Institute, owned the text. And the codex is known to this day as the Jung Codex. And he was quite familiar with the contents. He was a good friend with Hillel Quispe, who was a very young man at the time, and Jung was a very old man. But through Quispe became quite aware of the content. Not only that, Jung had studied the writings of another fellow by the name of G.R.S. Mead, who was one of the first translators of Gnostic material. He was a theosophist, a theosophical scholar. I think Mead died in the 1930s. He translated some of the few surviving manuscripts of Gnostic nature prior to the Nag Hammadi Library, one called Pistis Sophia. There's another large book he put together called Fragments of a Faith Forgotten with little scraps of Gnostic wisdom. And Jung had studied these both in the 1915-14 period and later. And actually, I have it on oral tradition that Jung sought Mead out when Mead was a very old man in great poverty in the 1930s and went to his house to thank him for the work he had done on the Gnostic materials. You know, the image of the Eucharist was seen by the alchemists as a parallel of the alchemical work. There are alchemical texts who treat the effort that they were engaged in as if it were a sacramental act in parallel to the Eucharistic act. And to say exactly what the correspondences are, to say what any symbol is impossible. Symbols are essentially statements of the psyche about things that cannot be expressed further with words. They are images that lead us into an archetypal realm. And anyone who stands up and says, well, this symbol here, this is what it means precisely, is full of those 22 feet of maybe 24 feet on that particular day. Because, you see, the very nature of a symbol is that it is a doorway to transcendence, shall we say. It opens to meanings multiple. To put it fixed into one meaning is to perhaps close the door upon meaning. To the sense that it opens up into deeper possibilities. To the sense it becomes multiple and, shall we say, even numinous. Having God power, having divine power. To that point, the symbol then starts, you know, yielding its true fruits. So, you know, to say, what does a cross mean? Well, crosses have appeared in the mythology across aeons of various peoples. It has multiple meanings dogmatically, theologically in Christianity. But it has meanings to each individual heart that encounters it that might indeed be inexpressible and totally unrelated to any dogma.
Yeah, that precise text comes from the Acts of John. The Acts of John is one Gnostic, in part Gnostic document, which survived for 2,000 years in monastic collections. The Acts were stories about things the apostles did after the death of Christ. And in the Acts of John, there are several chapters which are of a clearly Gnostic type. I mean, there's a lot of other material before and after. And in, I think, only one or two manuscript versions of the Acts of John does this section survive. And it's called The Mystery of the Cross and the Mystic Dance. And it tells the story of how Christ, on the night before his death, gathered his disciples together and asked them to dance. And it tells the story of the dance and of the words that he sang in the dance. In fact, it's a ritual that we reproduce using that text every Good Friday in our own church. It's a very special ceremony that always I find quite moving.